Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema, on Noon Forum. We'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 1966 documentary film A Time for Burning, directed by William Jersey and Barbara Connell. The film tells the story of Omaha's all-white Augustana Lutheran Church and their pastor, Reverend William Youngdahl's efforts to reach out to Hope Lutheran, a nearby all-black church. Reverend Youngdahl's suggestion was that 10 couples from Augustana visit 10 couples from Hope. Within weeks of making the suggestion, Pastor Youngdahl was forced to resign. The film shows the discussions which took place among the Augustana parishioners, meetings between ministry teams from the two churches, observations from members of the Hope congregation, and predictions by Omaha barber Ernie Chambers that Reverend Youngdahl's proposal would fail. This film is valuable in a historical sense in that it shows how much the city of Omaha and its people have changed in just 40 years. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday afternoon, October 18, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and members of the audience and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Walter Brooks, a contributing writer for the Omaha Star. The panel will then be introduced by Susan Butler, current pastor of Augustana Lutheran Church.
I want to welcome each and every one of you here on behalf of Film Streams, the Reader newspaper. I'm going to read a little list from this sponsorship list. I don't want to leave anybody out. I also want to draw your attention to the latest issue of the Omaha Star. Among other things, in this issue, I'm bringing it up, I did an interview with one of the young teenagers. She was 15 years old, Francine Riddick, at the time that A Time for Burning was made. And about a week or so ago, I got a chance to interview her. This young 15-year-old went on from Omaha, North Omaha, to get a master's and doctorate in American literature from Bryn Mawr College. And she lives in Seattle now and is just having a great career. And she had a lot to say as she reminisced about looking back at the making of this movie, how the black teenagers felt about their participation in it, and so forth. So I want to read a list of the sponsors here. Worst thing you can do is start the list and leave somebody out. So Mr. John Heaston, publisher of The Reader, who has done just, I particularly would like a round of applause right now for John Heaston and The Reader, and the entire staff of Film Streams Theater, the work that they're doing to make this whole thing come alive. Because of the light down here, I'm just going to have to kind of do this a little bit. Collaborating organizations, the Anti-Defamation League, Augustana Lutheran, Catholic Charities, Table Talk, Center for Human Diversity, Conference for Inclusive Communities, Film Streams, the Malcolm X Birth Site Foundation, the Mildred D. Brown Memorial Study Center, the Omaha Star Newspaper, Project Interfaith, University of Nebraska at Omaha Black Studies and Communications and Fine Arts Departments, University of Nebraska Lincoln College of Journalism, the Lutheran Film Associates, and the National Coalition of 100 Black Women, along with Metropolitan Community College. Please, let's have a round of applause for the wonderful sponsors. And it's not scratching the Omaha Star's back, but in the anniversary for the 70th anniversary, we created a foundation in the memory of the founder of the Omaha Star, Mildred D. Brown. It is called the Mildred D. Brown Memorial Study Center, and it is also one of the associations that was able to get a grant to help put this on.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Susan Butler. I am currently the pastor at Augustana Lutheran Church. I am welcoming you folks here today. I'm glad that you came, glad that you have such an interest in what's going on in Omaha in 2008, as well as what was going on in Omaha in the 60s and all the intervening years. As you can imagine, this movie has made a great impact on Augustana throughout those 40 years. We have been an ever-growing church and continue to grow as we live in this kingdom together. We're glad to have you here, and we know that there are questions that you want to ask of our panel members. People who are on the panel are folks that were involved in the movie, produced, directed, wrote, cleaned up afterwards, everything that happened to do with the movie. So I'm going to ask the gentleman and Jonas to introduce themselves, to tell you who they are, what their part in the film was, and then give you an opportunity to ask questions of anybody on the panel. We'll start with you, Ray. Tell Ray, what's your name?
Ray Christensen, and I was in the movie.
And I'm Bill Jersey, and I put him in the movie.
I'm Dan Goodwin, Sr. Much of the movie was filmed in my barber shop. In fact, the little boy is sitting right there right now that was in my chair. That's my son. Oh, I had a brother that spoke also from the sidelines. He's no longer, he's deceased.
I'm Jonas Orduna, and I have a twofold interest, I guess. I was a member of the Calvin Youth Group that did the exchange with Augustana, and also years later I was on staff at Augustana. So.
We do have a traveling microphone. There you go. If you would like to ask a question of anybody, raise your hand and the microphone will come to you, and just shout out to who you want to speak to.
This is a question for the director. I was just very curious how this project started, where did the idea come from, and I think I saw something like the Lutheran Church was associated with it, but if you could speak to that, please.
Well, it started, I was doing network television for NBC, and I'd done some primetime network shows, which got a lot of publicity and so forth. And so Bob Lee of Lutheran Film Associates had seen the shows, and he felt that the church wanted to do a show of that kind of technique and quality. So he contacted me and asked if I was interested in doing a film on the church's response to racial tension. And I was quick to say, as I think anyone would, you mean the church's response, not the church's solution, not the church's understanding of. And he said, yes, response. Neither he nor I knew what we were in for. We knew we were beginning a journey, and we knew we were beginning a journey with an unknown end, because, as I told him, I don't write scripts. And conventionally in the 60s, for films that were sponsored by organizations or institutions, a script was written, so that the sponsor would know exactly what he or she was getting, and then therefore they could take comfort that nothing embarrassing would occur. Well, the Lutheran Film Associates were willing to take the risk of doing an unscripted film. And perhaps one of the most meaningful moments for me was when the minister resigned. And I said to the Lutheran Church, this is not what you had in mind, this is not what I had in mind, but this is what's true. You don't have to release it. You can put it in a closet if you want. You own the film. And they said, no, we're going to release it, and they did. So I think that as filmmakers, you know, we can't do any better than those who fund us and support us allow us to do. The Medicis are not around anymore, so we don't have rich. There are rich individuals. There are actually some in this town. But in general, we have to raise money. It's difficult to raise money. And more and more people want assurances that they're going to get something that's going to be positive. And so the Lutheran Church really deserves a great deal of credit for taking the risk. And the Augustana Lutheran Church particularly deserves a great deal of credit for following through on, not just giving up on. They could well have turned their back on. Bill left. I left. And they could well have said, well, you know, that was a bad experience, but we'll wash our hands of it, and go back to who we are. And somehow or other, because of commitments of various people in this audience and to my left, the film, the congregation not only stayed alive, but found new life. And in my view, a much more valid and much more meaningful and much more significant, certainly a much more embracing life. And I thank you, Susan and Vic out there, and all of the others of you who participated in the, not the restoration of, but the renewal of Augustana Luther Church. Another question or comment?
I have two questions, if that's fair. But one is for Mr. Christensen. I was wondering if you could fill us in on what happened if and when you did take your stand against the congregation, or however that played out sort of once the movie finished, what sort of happened afterwards. And then the second question is maybe for all of you, but do you guys see any similarities today in the issues we're dealing with in the world where you sort of question your values and feel that you need to compromise things or take a stand to not compromise things, something to that effect?
You know, when you're going through a paradigm shift, you're bewildered, confused, and some people call it the pendulum effect. You're glad you do it. You're glad you're doing it. No, you shouldn't have done it. No, you're glad you're doing it and shouldn't have done it. And there was a lot of that at first. But then my wife, June, and I decided, no, this is our stand. And we really stuck to that, and proudly so. I lost my wife 4 years ago this coming November, and in our long goodbye, we took such joy and pride in the fact that we had made some good decisions. We felt our lives had purpose, and hey, that's not a bad thing in life, not a bad thing at all. Did I answer your question?
This whole experience for Augustana has been such a gift for us, because as you can imagine, when it first came out, it was embarrassing, and it was produced a lot of anger in the congregation. So between embarrassment and anger, a lot of healing started. The gift to us was that we had the unique opportunity to see on film who we were. You know, we all can assume or think we know who we are, but when you see it in vivid black and white, and see how you really think and how you really speak and how you really act in the world, what a gift for us to be able to say, are we like that? Is that who we are? Oh, my goodness. What must we do? Who can we become? What must we become? How can we be God's people in this kingdom in an effective way that's true to who we are as Christ's people, who we are as Omahans, who we are as white people in the kingdom. So we were so gifted to be able to see where we were and where we absolutely had to go. The journey has been arduous. The journey has been glorious. The journey has been quite fulfilling as we continue on the journey. We have become through the years a very welcoming church, a church of open arms and hearts and minds. And you can see that there was a point in our history when we probably weren't. I think that you would find us now to be very welcoming. I would hope you are. Maybe we need another vivid black and white movie about where we are today to know for sure. I think that the effect on us was wonderful, and I hope that we are continuing to continue the journey and live up to who we are becoming as God's people here.
I would throw it back to you as I throw it back to myself. Did you see yourself in this film? Because I see myself in this film. Not in the way it was articulated. No, first place, I don't use the same words. But the notion of being afraid that change would be introduced into my life that I have no preparation for, that I have no understanding of. The Harvard Business School called me and asked if I would send them up a print, and I thought that was curious. What does the Harvard Business School have to do with a film about a church in Omaha, Nebraska? Harvard being such a sophisticated institution and, you know, us being out here in the heartland. And it's a church and it's a minister. And what's that got to do with business? Well, they understood what the film was really about. It wasn't about a minister. It wasn't even about Omaha. It wasn't even about the church. It is about the difficulty of any individual who wants to bring about change in the circumstance in which there is resistance, denial, deceit, dishonesty, and fear. And that's what we have today. That hasn't changed. I want to get Dan Goodwin's reaction, because as a white man in 1965, I went into a black barbershop. Not only went into a black barbershop when I slept in my sacrificial goat, poor Reverend Youngdahl, knowing full well what Ernie Chambers would do to him. That was okay, right? You see, that was okay. But then when I came back and I said, no, I want to see you guys. I want to see you guys interacting. And what did you think, Dan, about I was going to do with footage? You started disagreeing with one another.
Okay, Bill spent a lot of time in the shop, so he sure knew Ernie, no question about it. I think you put the spotlight on racism. That's what it's about, which is still prevalent today. One of the examples I would use is, this is supposed to be a Christian nation. We have an administration in the White House. And I don't think the worst in the administration is George Bush. I see him more as a puppet. He has people that prop him up. I guess they help him say what he needs to say. But George Bush, they claim to be Christians, and they perpetrated an example. They perpetrated a war on lies. They had a war in Afghanistan. They didn't have a war in Iraq. They want to tell you that they're spreading democracy. This is all part of what we're talking about. They claim to be spreading democracy in Iraq. Well, I'm sure that if you could talk to the people in Iraq, and I never have, but I got common sense. And when you look and see the families are blown up, the water's poisoned, they don't have any jobs. But when they talk to those that are in cahoots with this country, and by the way, I don't want to see anything happen to this country. Everything I like is here. So this war was perpetrated on one organization came up with 935 lies. And people want to pretend this is not happening. Now, these are people of color also. I tie it into what's going on in this country right here. So if people would really look at what's going on, they wouldn't get a vote. The Republicans would not get a vote in this election. And that's part of it. I didn't mean to go on and on, but
that's right. You stopped preaching and went to meddling, but that's okay.
I can't help it. Yeah.
That's why I loved being in the barbershop. I was with my friends.
Yep.
Wonderful people who I loved then and love now, and it's such a treat to be with you.
Okay, that's good to
hear. Thank you much. Yeah. You know, there's somebody else in the audience. There was another one of the young women at was it Calvin Memorial? Is there a young woman who was at Calvin Memorial during the making of this film, or Hope Lutheran? There's the last image I saw, and you notice that I have an eye for beautiful women. So I'm no fool, and I pick them that last. You see, my movie last and the good-looking woman last. You're looking great. Kamel Steed.
I guess the question that I have, though, and I'd like to present to the panel, is that...
I wanted to introduce you to talk about yourself. We didn't want another question. Just kidding.
It struck me the same way that we're still fearful, you know, this time 40 years later with this election. There is an individual who is campaigning on fear, There are people who have expressed fear and anxiety and distrust because they're faced with, again, all that was presented in the documentary of the possibility of an individual, an African-American, posed to change history. Well, one of the things that I notice is that everything has changed, but nothing has changed. You know, we've just reached another plateau, you know. And will America be able to step up? Will America be able to step up to this individual? And I don't really want to preach politics, but we know that this man has what it takes to lead, and we need leadership so desperately right now. He has, I think, exhibited a skill and the politics that has probably make him a political genius so far in this century, what he's been able to pull off. The question is America ready? And I still think there are a lot of people out there that aren't ready.
Well, all I can say is that those who are ready should stand up and move. And if enough of us start moving, then maybe the whole crowd, because crowd psychology works all the time in this country. So that's good news and bad news all wrapped up in one. And also, I think a reminder, which I will point, throw in Ernie's face, Barack had a white mother. This is not about race. A white mother, a black son, this is about America. This is about the possibilities of hope, of realizing the possibility through hard work. Race is always there and can become a factor, but it is not always about race. That can have that. That's how African Americans can overreact to situations, because every time they feel offended, they feel it's about race. It's not always about race. And we have to be discriminating in the best sense of the word. We have to understand whether it's about race, whether it's about power, whether it's about intelligence, whether it's about status. You know, so it's not. It's about feminism. It's about being gay or lesbian, or you know, it's not always about race. So we're emphasizing the importance and significance of it here, and nobody in this room, I hope, is going to diminish the importance of race.
This lady over here has been trying to talk forever. Right over here.
My question is to Mr. Goodwin. I think maybe this question has already been asked and answered, but I look at the demographics of the prisons. And to me, that gives a very subtle reminder to all of us that not much has changed.
I agree.
And I wonder if perhaps Mr. Christensen could respond to Mr. Goodwin's analysis and maybe say what he thinks are specific you know, indicators that something has changed. I think maybe Mr. Goodwin would agree with me, and Mr. Christensen may not. But I'd like both your response, if I may, please.
But exactly what are you asking me to respond to?
Do we see the demographics of the prison population show me that not much has changed specifically?
Yeah.
Do you agree or disagree with me?
I agree with that.
But now he wants the chance to attack me.
Not really attack you, but there's no doubt about race playing a heavy role.
Absolutely.
Eric Dyson was on Larry King, I think it was last night or the night before.
Yes.
And I agree with him 100%. And he made the comment that if Obama, he's so far above McCain in this race, that if he were Caucasian, he would be 25% ahead rather than 5%. That's a good example.
That's true.
And the way they did Michelle, when Michelle and her husband became Michelle Obama, when he got the Democratic nomination, and she said for the first time that she was proud of this country. That makes sense to anybody, at least any black person, and really any white person with real conscience and understands and remembers and realizes the things that black people went through real big time, especially in your southern states back during the 60s. John Lewis, what he took, he got pounded. He has a plate in his head even today, and the way he was attacked for saying the things that were honest and true, but for political reasons, they have to start backing up. It's race, without a doubt. It's race.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I would just like to add, because we've been having conversations all day long, and it's been really wonderful, that one of the things we talked about this morning was when you were talking about people contextualizing the film, and they were contextualizing with the question, where are you coming from? I think for myself as an African American, there's nothing that happens in America that's not about race to me. That's part of my journey as a person of color in America. It's always about race. Everything I do when I step outside my door, it's about race. And I don't think that I long for the day when that's not the case. I don't think I'm going to live to see it. But I think that, you know, as we began to talk the semantics of is it about race or if it isn't, it depends on where you're sitting.
Exactly. Yeah, that's different.
And that hasn't changed for me from the time for Burning till today.
Jones, I wanted to follow up on something. I'm a teacher at Omaha North High School now, and I was thinking about you when you were a teenager and you were one of the few kids that ended up in the sanctuary at Augustana Lutheran and what that must have felt like, and apparently that wasn't an entirely receptive experience. Whether or not you noticed it or not, I obviously wouldn't know that. As a teacher now, I find it difficult to inspire my kids to put themselves out there like that, and I don't know if it's they think the job is done or if they just don't think there is anything that can be accomplished. And I would just be interested in your perspective on how you put yourself out there at that point and what students today, black and white, could be doing to make the world different. I already know the voting part. I've got that covered.
In 1964, 65, and 66, there weren't many places else to go. You know, any suggestion anybody made that said that we were not going to have doors closed in our faces was a good step to take. I think we were taught courage by the people before us. I was watching the movie, and I was looking at Lois and Ray Metoyer and some of the other people that I felt like were role models, and all of the times that I showed up to sing and Ernie Chambers was there to speak, and everything he said went in my ear and resonated and bounced around and got me excited. I think that's the age in which inspiration happens. And for that was the most powerful group of young people in that youth group at Calvin Memorial. Because we didn't know, if we had fear, the fear didn't exist in a way that said somebody's going to harm you. People were harming us all the time. And what we wanted was to make the harm stop. As for the kids today, I think it depends on the questions you ask them. It depends on the circumstances you set before them. I think our kids are just as inspirable. I think it depends on what you are presenting and what's the promise. What's the promise of that inspiration? Because that's when you're going to get the reaction.
Thanks, Jonas. There's a man up here on the very top row.
My response has changed about 10 times as the I was 6 years old at the time getting my hair cut in there, and while I probably didn't fully understand what was going on, as a strong Christian today, I believe that my presence there was prophetic, because here we are 42 years later, and amongst blacks, what you're witnessing still is a hurt from the trauma that has occurred. And the question in the film was, when do you do the right thing? When do you do the moral thing? And when you don't move and do the right thing immediately, it festers and it grows and becomes a bigger problem. And bridging that gap is still hard today. It's ironic, while most of, I was ordained as a minister in a North Omaha church, not far away, but God moved me, and I'm in a suburban church in Millard, a place I would have never thought I would be. There's a reason for that, and yet there's a longing in me to bridge that gap. Okay, she talked about it. North High, what's wrong today? Okay, as a Christian, God is still speaking to us. The amazing thing is, nobody ever said to anybody in the film, what do you think God thinks about how you feel toward these people, or how does God view this moral issue? And maybe someone did. I think he stood up very strongly and got a revelation that, hey, we need to move now. You know, so I would say to everyone here, it's not about saying that you're a Christian with your mouth. And yet God is merciful. Thank God he's merciful. He gives us time to step in line with what his will is. So here we are still today. What are the moral issues that God is looking at today? What is God's heart today? It's about his kingdom, not ours. What is God trying to do today? What is God? It wasn't about just Augustana Lutheran Church. God is speaking to every person, every Christian. Where are you with me today? And he's still speaking through this film right now.
Thank you. There's a guy up here with a microphone.
I moved to Omaha in 1968, and I saw the film about that time. And of course, it was just a really powerful, just riveting experience. Seeing it today, 40 years later, almost, you know, to the month or something, it's just a profoundly depressing experience. I mean, just about lost it halfway through the film. As we heard earlier, you know, it just reminds how much hasn't changed. And if we want to know, you know, the why things haven't changed, it's up there on the screen of these, or just ordinary folks who just are terrified of even the slightest change. So I'd be curious, two things. Are panelists, has your sense of the film changed over these 40-some years? And are there any other people in the audience who have seen it, you know, decades apart? And, you know, has it changed or changed your understanding of it?
A part that hasn't been addressed in my mind were the tough years right after Bill left, and the work, the dedication, the commitment, the sacrifice that Vic Schoonover, Pastor Vic Schoonover, picked up the challenge and worked for many, many years. And without that, I don't think there would have been a church there today. And Vic needs to be commended for all of his really important work. Vic, thank you.
Vic, do you mind standing up so we can thank you?
Also, I want to take this minute to say that I talked with Bill Youngdahl less than a week ago, and I said, Bill, if you were here, what would you ask or say? And it was very simple. He said, I would ask, are you making progress? Okay. What would you say, Bill? And if you are, celebrate it. Celebrate the progress. No matter how slow, you've got to keep working and celebrating progress so you strengthen yourself for the next challenge. That was from Bill.
The guy in the back now has a microphone.
No, she does.
It's just moving.
I just look like a guy from back here.
No, he had his hand up, and I can tell.
No, I'm kidding. I just want to address the whole issue of race, because it is always about race. It is about race and racism and whatever other isms. Yes, you're right. There are many isms. I try not to diminish other people's pain. But in the United States, we have never admitted to the fact that we had a true apartheid. We like to give it nice words. So we have never done the work that other countries may have done as we address apartheid, which was a legalized system of keeping people down. We always like to say this was a Southern issue, but as we know, it's an international issue. There are always people who have to be over someone. Whatever the reason is, whether it's physical, economic, it doesn't matter. But I do want to say this film is very powerful because if we are honest, we know some of these same things are going on every day. Same discussions are going on every day. If someone says to me that my daughter married a black man, and then she says, and now I have a black grandbaby, So I have to ask the question, why is the grandbaby still called black? You know, does her daughter have nothing to do with it except as a vessel for the child to be born? These things still continue. I work with people on Indian reservations. It's the most shameful thing that we as Americans fail to address every day. But I'll finally say the issue about it being about race is about where you sit, because it has to do with daily indignities that you may not understand. It has to do with wondering if something doesn't happen, if it is because of my race. That is a terrible legacy that my children still bear and my grandchildren will probably still bear, because we make it about race and racism in the United States. But I hope that those of you who are here will be the champions as we move forward. It takes everyone in this room to be willing to have a critical discussion to say, yes, it may not feel like race to you, but it's always about race. It's about mine or it's about someone else's. And this is not a perception thing. It's a reality.
Well, it's about race to you, but it's about sexuality to a lesbian or a gay or a transgender. It's about other things to other people. It's about being female or male. It's about gender for a lot of people. Well, look at the pictures of the group of eight, and they're all white men except one German woman. Look at any pictures of all of those who created this subprime mess. And the subprime mess is not
but
just about race.
But before we go to the subprime mess, if I just may, we're going off the point. And that is that, yes, there is discrimination, as I have admitted to. But then you have to look at the stacking effect. If you are white and you are uneducated, that's bad. But if you add black to the mix, that's worse. Yeah. If you are a new immigrant with language issues, that's doubly, triply worse. And then please, let's look at, as someone mentioned, the prison population. How can it be in the state of Iowa and probably in the state of Nebraska that 70% of the people in the prison are not white? Come on. There are still people who wonder if I'm inherently bad and I just happen to be one of the good ones who didn't make it to where I was supposed to go. I mean, this is conversations that I have with people in this town, people who have wealth, have means, have education, have sophistication, have traveled, and still wonder at my ability to string sentences together. This is real. I do not feel angry. I am just trying to be the voice of what is real, the things that we continually push away. And yes, as a woman, I understand that. As now an overweight woman, I understand that.
Another level, right.
You know, I mean, I look fine. Yeah, I know that, but I'm not in many ways. But we have to be real. We have to look at the reality that race and racism is a huge issue in this country, bigger than we are willing to admit. If it was not, there would not be those of us in the flock here today, because the flock is here today. This is the choir. Some of us don't know the song as well as some of the others. Some of us didn't go to choir practice at all, but we're trying to start today. But this is the flock. So I just wanted to say, if you ever say it's not about race, it probably comes from the position of feeling like race is not an issue for you.
No,
thank
it's
you
not
very
true.
Much. And would you, put, would you give the true. Microphone to the... We're going to get this guy yet. There you go. Yay, thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Leo, and I have to say that purposely because that lady down there with the red hair who says she works at North High, that's Miss Erdenberger. And she, the first year that she came to North High, I had her my senior year where I was slacking, I didn't care, and I was 2 minutes away from gang activity. She gave me a small bookmark that said, never, never, never quit. It was gold. And it had a felt back, and that was the first thing a teacher ever gave to me. It was her who gave it to me. It's ironic that I'm in this room, but it was her that gave it to me. And it's really weird that I ended up here. It's so weird that I ended up here. Because yesterday I walked out of a meeting angry and frustrated and was across the street from Augustana Church. I didn't recognize it until I saw the video today. And I was so frustrated because the job that I do is to try to change the community that I'm in now. And it was shocking because it all came full circle today. in to see Miss Erdenberger down there, saying that she's trying to reach out to other guys like me. It worked. And that's what got me here. It worked. So thank you very, very, very much.
I would like to say that Mrs. Erdenberger is a member of Augustana Lutheran Church.
Okay. And I also had a comment that that we say that I agree that race still exists, but there's an issue with that because it's our words is one of the simplest things that we can change that we choose not to. We still say black. We still say white. I hang around a group that makes me do push-ups whenever I say white or black because we have to get rid of that. Once we get rid of that, we can force the change. But if you still use those words to this day, then you are still egging that on. When I watch the news and I see a guy 10 times lighter than me who can pass for white and they say black male 5'10", look out for him on Crime Stoppers, I'm looking out for myself because I might get pulled over too because it said black male, even though he looks nothing like me. So we have to take away those contexts, those labels, yes, and try to wage forward with that. But the question that I pose, and this is for the panel and everyone else in the audience, what small step are you taking to remove that label from each other and move forward this movement of unity?
Where's the other microphone?
We've got one here.
Does he have a question?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, in kind of a response to the teacher and a response to actually what the gentleman just said, I come from a biracial family. I live with a black mom, and she remarried a black dad, but my dad is Puerto Rican, so it's kind of a nice mix. But I would have to disagree with erasing color. God gave us color. God gave us cultures, and God gave us these things that I think that instead of erasing them and staying with colorblind rules and regulations, which are, by the way, being attacked right now. But I really disagree with just trying to say we have to erase these things. I think it's more an embracing of those differences that is required because that's the problem. Because we can't erase what we see. You know, there's a difference in pigmentation for a reason. And I really believe, you know, And once I got to college, I started really thinking about my race and my ethnicity. And with Senator Obama running, I really had to think about things. You know, wow, what is, you know, is he saying? He said he's black and he's white. And I've always said that I'm black and Puerto Rican or Puerto Rican and black or whatever, whatever way I said it first. But I really would ask everyone to think about, do we really want to erase it? Erase the culture, erase these things that make us so unique. And I really feel like our cultures, our colors, everything is really unique, and God made us that way for a reason. And I just would ask that everybody think about it instead of erasing the white and black. I mean, we know that it has a lot of negative connotations. However, a start could be to embrace these differences that have for so long caused barriers in the community and could possibly be a step instead of trying to say, let's be colorblind. You know, let's embrace the color, embrace the differences. And that's part of affirmative action, which I have a question, is my question for you. What do you think about the about affirmative action probably in the time of the video and how, where do you think it should go today, since it's going to be on the ballot as Initiative 424, your comments?
You know, real quick, I wanted to respond to the young man up there. I understand the point that he's trying to make, but that can never be. I think what we need to emphasize is everybody, regardless of race or regardless of color, we're all human beings, so we all have respect for each other. It should be as simple to me, and I've said this many times, as simple as the golden rule. Treat people like you want to be treated, and then you can disregard all the rest of it. If you do that, that takes care of it to me. You can't eliminate. You're not going to be able to eliminate black or white or Afro-American or whatever the terms might be. And personally, I don't see anything wrong with any of them.
I'm against purple people.
You, oh,
Yeah, I don't like purple people. You have any purple people here? Oh, that's good. I haven't offended anybody. That's good. No, I think the notion of affirmative action, which is your question, I think that we need affirmative action all over the place. We need to take those actions that enable those who have been crippled by race, by prejudice against gays or lesbians or Indians or women. You know, I think women need affirmative action in certain situations. So I don't know about laws. I have a little trouble with laws because life is not lived. You know, every time you make a law, usually someone gets helped and someone gets hurt. So I think personally that the affirmative action, the legal part of it is a tough one for me. I don't know what to do about that.
Right here in the gray sweater.
Okay, I had actually some Augustana questions. The first one was, how long after the movie was made did it take for Augustana to become fully integrated and comfortably integrated? And the second question is, while I was watching the movie, I was drawing a lot of parallels between the whole Reverend Creech incident here, which I'm sure people know that was a Reverend Creech, at, I believe it was First Methodist, did a lesbian marriage ceremony, and it split the church down the middle, and it was
right.
a huge conflagration. And
right.
Yeah, so the movie brought to mind that instance, and I wondered if Augustana is a reconciling church toward gays and lesbians. So those are my two questions.
We are reconciling in Christ's congregation, which is the organization within the Lutheran Church. I think most denominations have some organizational structure. We are one of two congregations in Nebraska Lutheranism that are reconciling in Christ congregations. We have a number of gay and lesbian, transgendered people in our congregation. Part of the what reconciling in Christ congregations do is to be welcoming and affirming and as integrative as we can with all people, no matter whether they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender. So we are very active in GLBT ministry, yes. Yes, sir.
I have a couple questions that, and I'm sorry, I don't remember your guys' names, but the barbershop owner.
Yeah.
And the
Dan Goodwin, Esquire. What's the address
thanks.
In case anybody needs a haircut?
So Dan, first off, I'm interested to hear what kind of dynamic Ernie Chambers played in that barbershop in the 1960s. Then I want to know from the gentleman to the right of the director, and I'm sorry, I can't remember your name either.
Bill Jersey.
No, Ray. What it feels like to be completely dressed down by Ernie Chambers?
Who, me?
No, Ernie played an extremely powerful role, like as he did in the film when he first came on the scene, even before he was ever elected to any office. So, anytime there were problems in the community that made news, he's the first one. And very young, people would call him. To take issue with those things before the city council or wherever, confronting the police department, you name it. So he's been a force almost from day one. To be honest, and I don't mean it in a bragging way, but and I'm certainly not complaining, but Ernie, although everybody respected him, Ernie couldn't have worked in any shop but mine because people feared the reaction that would come from, you know, Caucasians control is in the majority, and they feared that it would anger white people, which it did, and still does today.
Yeah, Ernie probably tore me, attempted to tear me to pieces, but I'm not as terrible as the minister. I'm not as nice a guy.
Yeah, you're tough.
So Dan just said I'm tough. I knew where it was coming from. To me, Ernie is a very gifted, extraordinarily gifted man. In fact, I remember the last time we met was in a bar in Omaha. I don't know what bar, and I don't know whether either one of us were drinking, but I remember saying to Ernie, with your gift for rhetoric,
He's kind never had a drink in his life. Just I want
so
to
then
that.
We weren't drinking.
No.
Oh,
in
good.
Fact, I doubt that you met him at a bar.
Oh, really?
I think the first place you met him was in the shop. Don't you remember?
Oh, no. The first place I met him was in the shop, yeah.
Yeah.
But the last time I saw him, maybe we were having a ginger ale together, huh?
Trust me, he's never drank.
I'll trust you. Are you kidding? I trust you with my life. Anyhow, somewhere in Omaha, Nebraska, my last time together with Ernie, I said to him, you know, Ernie, you should be in government. Government is where you can have the broadest possible influence. And he said to me, never. I would never go into government. You have to be fake to be in government. To get into government, to stand up, you have to be fake, and I won't be fake. Well, the latter part of the statement was true. He wouldn't, he was, will not be, and will never be fake.
No, you're right there.
But he was wrong about the first part, that he belonged in government, and I don't know that I talked him into it, but I'd like to think I had something to do with it. And those of you who didn't like what he did in government, I'm sorry, but I liked what he did.
I think maybe you were addressing the part of that question to me.
Oh, yes.
Is that true? Let me answer it this way. I'm here on this panel because I first checked to make sure Ernie would not be here.
I don't know if he's kidding or not.
No, he literally said that. Yeah, he literally said that.
Okay.
He said, I don't want to go through that again. No, to me, Ernie is a trickster. In the Northwest Coast Indian tribes, there are individuals whose job it was not to educate or inform in the conventional sense, but to trick people into understanding things that they didn't want to understand. And to me, that's Ernie's role. I don't listen to Ernie in order to get information, in order to get facts, not even to get opinion. But because he forces you when he speaks, for me at least, he forces me when I listen to him to rethink the way I've looked at the world, to rethink the way I've looked at myself, to rethink the way I've looked at African-American people, or whatever. He is a trickster, and I think that's an important role, and I hope he continues for a long time.
Okay, we have one more question, one more microphone. There you go.
This is from Mr. Jersey. What she said so eloquently, what you did beautifully, I saw this film before. The first time I saw it was amazing because you forced people who didn't have to think about something to think about something. Mm-hmm. And that was the most amazing thing about A Time for Burning is that you forced not the ones with their backs up against the wall, because like we say, we know our backs up are against the wall, right. But the ones doing the pushing. You know, you made them think, how do you really feel? How do you really feel? It was a very intimate thing. You didn't embarrass anybody. It was privately, you know, each individual had to search their own soul. And how do you really feel about, you know, we all need to ask that, you know, the ones doing the pushing. How do I feel about black people? How do I really feel about Mexicans? You know, it doesn't have to be a public display. It's just when you're by yourself. And that's when you'll know, is there still racism? If you still feel funny when you walk into a room of people that don't look like you and you feel a little tense, there's still racism. And you brought that out so wonderfully in your film. The first time I saw it, I thought it was brilliant. So I still think it's just timeless. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vic wants to say something else. If you could hand the microphone just right up to Vic, and this will have to be the last.
I just wanted to say something to my white brothers and sisters here. I'm a racist. I try to be a recovering racist. It's just like alcoholism. I was raised in it. Yep. I breathed it. I was taught it. And so I'll always be a racist. I would like not to be a racist. And so I try not to be. And so I'm a recovering racist. That's one thing. You can't be raised in America without being that way. Secondly, get tougher, folks, white folks. Don't let your feelings be hurt so easily. Every time I've noticed throughout the years, we do something that we think is worth of congratulations. Or, oh, you did good. But, you know, that's not it. The thing that's lacking in the film and lacking in most of our lives today is that Augustana went through pain. People there went through pain. But it was nothing compared to the pain that the blacks went through every day. And we have to recognize that and realize that and empathize with it and confess it and stop being so hurt when what we think we've done isn't appreciated. We don't do it for appreciation. We do it because it's right.
This is just a comment. In the movie, when the two young black women were on the couch, the one on the left was in a striped shirt, the one on the right was in like a white sweater. That's Francine Reddick. And when I interviewed her, and again, the interview is in the Omaha Star this week's issue, she told me that if I had a chance to address the audience, please say something about the parents of Calvin Memorial Presbyterian Church. They showed the movie at the church when it first came out as a benefit. She saw it again when she was in college and she was in the Black Student Union, and she just has a lot to say about what that experience was like to see it in the midst of a very militant environment of African Americans. Then she said she saw it last year, rented it on Netflix. Give Netflix a point. And she said the thing that she wanted was to remind people of what those parents did for the young African American teenagers in that church. They were so protective of them. This experience really put them in a very vulnerable position, and she talks a lot about what it felt like to go to that church and be so disrespected as they were. But she says, in as she looks and got older, she realized that the parents are really trying to help acculturate the children to a world that they didn't make, but a world that they were going to have to go out and compete in and live in. And she just says, please be sure and remind that audience, because it's a great movie, and she just really loves looking at it now and realizing, you know, I was in that. I was a part of this historic event, and I just want people to know that we want to give so much respect to our parents for what they did in their role in this whole thing. And people may watch the movie and kind of like not get that so much. So I just wanted to throw that out on behalf of Francine Reddick.
You've been listening to a panel discussion on Noon Forum, which followed a screening at Film Streams of the 1966 documentary film A Time for Burning, directed by William Jersey and Barbara Connell. The members of the panel were the film's director, William Jersey, Ray Christensen, an Augustana parishioner who appeared in the film, Bill Goodwin, an Omaha barber who also appeared in the film, and Jonas Orduna, a staff member of Augustana. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday afternoon, October 18th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.